Welcome to Milkmaids Podcast, the unconventional homesteading podcast. I'm Stephanie from Wyoming.
And I'm Tara from Montana. Join us each week as we take a deep dive into an inclusive homesteading topic from canning, dairy animals, gardening, animal husbandry, and everything in between.
Hey, Tara.
Hey.
How's it going?
Good. Hopefully your internet cooperates. I don't know why it's your internet this time. It's usually mine.
Especially because I have fiber.
Right.
I should not be having internet issues.
Yes.
Right. But who knows? Alas, here we are.
Hello.
Hopefully it sounds okay. But it probably won't because I still have my baby, in case anybody's wondering. He's wide awake over
That's
there.
Okay.
So he'll be doing his stuff.
By now.
Right. So who are we shouting out this week?
This week, our shout out goes to the Black Farmer Fund. And this is taken right from their website, but I feel like it was important to use their own words to describe their incredible work. And it says, the idea to create Black Farmer Fund came from two Black farmer activists, Karen Washington and Olivia Watkins, meeting at a conference in 2017 and sharing frustrations about the lack of financial assistance available for Black farmers. They decided that there needed to be a means for community members to access capital that recognized the historical discrimination of lending and banking that informs the present reality of Black communities. So the Black Farmer Fund does have many goals, including to function as an investment vehicle in New York State, that's where they're located, to center Black farmers and business owners, and to serve as a place for community members of varying economic backgrounds to invest, and to collaborate with Black farmers and business owners to increase the number of Black business owners. The one that really stood out to me quite a bit was their desire to understand and move away from the historically ingrained attitude of scarcity and adopt an abundance mindset. So their website is www.blackfarmerfund.org, and you can check out their pilot program farmers, herbalists, and collectives that have been selected to receive support from the Black Farmer Fund. And if you can read their bios, I definitely suggest you do. They're doing incredible things. And if you'd like to donate, you can do so on their website. They offer a PayPal donation link, Amazon Smile donations, and stock gifts.
That Amazon Smile thing, I don't know if people know this, but it's so easy. It's not an actual donation. Like, you don't put your own money to it.
No.
This is hard to describe, but you just shop on Amazon like you normally would through Amazon Smile, and a percentage of all your purchases go to that charity. That's all it is. Yeah.
I'm so doing that currently. I think everyone should.
Yeah, it doesn't affect you at all.
No. Living rurally, you have to use Amazon sometimes. So if you are using Amazon, find an Amazon Smile that speaks to you and use them.
Yeah.
I do that. Do you do that?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's super easy.
Yeah. Our dog rescue has one. So I've always done that.
Oh, yeah. And then my son has apraxia. It's a speech condition. So that's the one I chose to do.
Yeah.
And you can change it, like whatever you feel like doing for that 6 months or whatever. That's great.
Yep.
And keep in mind, this isn't only limited to Black farmers, because as we've talked about before, our food system is so much more than farming. Their program includes funds for Black vendors, food distributors, catering businesses, and other Black food-based business owners. So check them out. We'll have their link in the show notes.
Sweet. Yeah, that's awesome. If you want to ask us a question or send us a shout out, please send us an email at milkmaidspodcast@gmail.com, or you can reach us on Facebook or Instagram at Milkmaids Podcast. Any reviews, leave us a review. Rate, review, subscribe. That really helps us out.
It does.
Speaking of which.
Yes.
We have another Canadian review.
We did get another Canadian review, and I was looking at our numbers the other day, and I think it's only like 6% of people who listen to us are from Canada.
So every one of them has left a review.
That's how nice Canadians are. They're right. Like, I listen to this. I'm one of six Canadians that listen, so I'm leaving a review. So we got one from our Canadian listener name, and they're just like on Apple, they give you a little name. It's Ash Coro. And the review says, my favorite homesteading podcast. These girls are funny and down to earth. So thank you so much. We really appreciate that.
Yeah, I know. It really does make our day. You guys don't even know.
Right. Because we put in so many hours.
Yeah.
So when we get a review and it's like one sentence even, that's awesome.
Right. Just the stars are cool. I'll take it.
The stars are cool. Yes. Keep doing the thing, right?
Right.
Just because I've had a couple of people ask, we are in the works of getting a Patreon started, but we don't want to offer anything like half-assed. Like, I would feel terrible if we just had a Patreon and offered zero things, which some Patreons do. I mean, it's nice to just support people And I guess we're just not like that. So we're shooting for fall of this year, and we will add tiers and offer different things according to those tiers, including our outlines, checklists, because Stephanie's really good at those checklists. You might as well offer them.
Gotta put this type A to use somehow, man.
And we do a lot of research for these outlines. It's filled with knowledge. So the hours that we are spending can be utilized by people who are willing to pay even $5 a month. That being said, we appreciate all of our listeners. And please, if you're not in a place where you can sign up for Patreon, don't do it. Like, you don't owe anybody that. All your support does absolutely help, like reviewing, reaching out to us, sharing, rating, all of that.
My farm update does lead us to our next topic. Do you guys remember that one time that we did
that?
This
one
podcast
time
is so flipping expensive for me.
That's, yeah. No, it I was need all to of quit. Us. It's all of us, yes.
Like, remember that one time we talked about livestock guardian dogs? The funny part about that is they're like, at one point I actually said, this is the most expensive episode we've ever done.
Yeah.
Why not?
You weren't joking.
No, because that started a ball down the hill that I could not push back up said hill. And now we have a puppy.
And surprise puppy.
Surprise puppy. So anyways, we got a great Pyrenees puppy. Her name's Freya. She's the cutest thing that anybody's ever seen.
A little fluff ball.
A little floof. She's super fun. So we got her last week. And she's been doing really, really well. It's interesting because the dogs that we've had before are German wire hair pointers. I still have a German wire hair pointer. And they're very intense dogs. They're very, very, very intense dogs. So it's not that they need you, because in a lot of respects, they're very independent. But they, like, in the house, her name's Stevie. And she, like, has to be touching you at all points. She's like a toddler.
Like, has to be
touching you completely at all points in time. If you're not petting her, fine. But like, if she could have her face just like millimeters away from your face, that'd be perfect at all times.
Right.
This little puppy's like, oh, I'll just lay over here on the floor. I'm good.
It's fine. This is fine.
She has such a different personality. It's been really fun to get to know her a little bit. I'm excited to see how she grows and fits into our situation here, but we're going to use her as a house dog, a guard, like not even not a livestock guardian dog, just like she's a baby. She's a family companion for us.
And to walk you to the barn because you're terrified of bears.
Yes. The bears, the January bears are my least favorite bears.
The January bears, the hardy bears that don't sleep.
Right. This is my favorite. Brian's like, there's not even any bears out right now.
They're
I'm
literally
going
sleeping.
To get eaten by a bear in January.
Just know
Mark
it.
My grave with that. Oh my
now
gosh.
Now you won't. You got a livestock, a Stephanie guardian dog.
I've got a 12-pound floof right now.
Yeah, that's true. The baby thought that was funny too.
He's got lots to say. Poor thing's been through the ringer today. Other farm updates. I don't think I have much. We separated off the goats, so we're just waiting on them to pop at this point.
Yes.
My chickens have sporadically stopped laying eggs, which is cool.
Weird.
I know, they haven't laid an egg in several days. My coop is littered with feathers. Like, no one really looks like they're molting, but there's
it's
feathers
a secret
everywhere
molting.
So they might be like starting the molt. Also though, they're 13 months, which is really early to be molting. So I don't know that they are molting or not. I'm not 100% sure. I should be getting really good eggs with the daylight now, but I'm not. So I'm grateful for all those eggs that I freeze dried over the winter, and we're using those, but we'll see what ends up happening with this. We're planning on hatching a few more, but that requires eggs, as it turns out.
Kind of need those.
We need more chickens to get more eggs, but we need more eggs to get more chickens. So
what came first?
Neither in our case.
Neither.
So anyways, that's like the current it's like there's always one of those on the farm.
For sure.
just is what it is. That's about it. How about you?
We are weaning one set of piglets this weekend from the mama. They're 6 weeks old today, I think.
Oh, okay.
So they're ready to go. And the problem with the two pigs is they're like full sisters. And then the one just has five, and she's just degrading so fast.
Oh,
and
really?
The other one has eight, perfectly fine. Hasn't lost any weight.
Oh, weird.
And the one that has five, we're giving her double rations, doing everything. She's been dewormed. There's no reason she should be, other than she's just not good. Like, she's not a good one to keep, because when they get degraded that fast, it's just not, like, good for them either. Like, I feel bad. She looks so skinny. And she does have like a bigger frame, but I don't know.
That's what I was going to ask. Is she that much bigger? Because I haven't seen him in... No, I did see him in person together. I don't remember though.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is she that much bigger?
Yeah. She just has like a big frame. So I don't know if that's why. And the other one's like short and squatty. But it's like you look at her and you're like, oh my gosh. But she's really getting, yeah, like 20 pounds of feed a day or something ridiculous like that.
Oh, geez.
So I need to pull those piglets and I'll do that this weekend. It'll be fine. So I'm going to give her one more chance and then make decisions from there.
Yeah. Are you going to put him right back in with the boar?
Yeah. And then hopefully get rid of him after these two are pregnant. So
okay.
That's what's going on. And then Dixie, every single day, I get less and less milk. And then I did a CMT. We're not drinking it because it tastes awful. And then I did a CMT on her today. And I can't tell if one quarter is a little bit like thickened up. And I'm like, what is going on now? What could be going on now?
Yeah.
It's just a sign that she needs to dry up. But again, I'm like between a rock and a hard place. So that's what's going on.
You want a goat?
Yeah, pretty much. That's remember, what I'm like. I'm so tired of these cows.
Remember that time I asked you if you wanted a full-size goat and milk? And you said, what would I need that for? I've got plenty of milk.
Now, yeah. That's a problem, though. My husband doesn't want goat milk, which, again, he doesn't even drink the milk that we have, so...
Put goat milk in his car. I promise he will not be able to tell the difference.
I know.
I promise.
I know.
I know people have that though. And he's got a different set of reasons, but.
Right.
Yeah.
Anyway, does that lead us to our new main topic? Sort of.
Milk animals.
Sort of, because
parasites.
I am deworming my piglets this weekend too. So our main topic this week is parasites. It's a topic that no one asked for, but we are going to cover it anyway, like a lot of our topics.
Really all we do.
Right. You didn't ask for this? That's too bad. We're going to provide it. You could turn it off, I guess, if you don't want to hear about parasites.
Or you could send us an email with a topic request. You're right. In control of this, not us. That's
all. We're just doing what we want, I guess.
Right.
So ever since humans have started domesticating animals for use, there have been parasites in both humans and animals. And even before this, I don't know, living creatures are gross. What do you want me to say?
Yeah, they've evolved with everybody else.
Yes. We have parasites. And everything has parasites, basically. Mm-hmm. Parasites have parasites.
This is true.
It's true. They're just everywhere. And this can mean a loss of profit and can become a significant cause of disease and death. It's important to familiarize yourself with parasites and the tools necessary to prevent and treat them. So to understand parasites, you need to understand what types are out there. So let's start with some common terms you're going to want to know, hopefully prior to even getting your first animal. So hopefully you're hearing this prior to getting any animals. If not, you're going to see an animal shitting spaghetti and you're going to be concerned. Also, side note, if you told me like at 17 years old that I would be 32 and excited to talk about parasites on a podcast, I would have thought you were out of your mind. What about you?
Did
you
see yourself? I would have been like, yeah, no, totally.
You're like,
I was getting ready to go to college for a biology degree.
Yeah.
That seems about right.
This is right up your alley.
Yeah.
So by definition, a parasite is anything that lives on or in a host and gets their nutrients from or at the expense of the host while giving nothing in return. So it's not a symbiotic relationship here.
Right.
There are three different parasite types you need to know about. So protozoa, these are single-celled organisms that can multiply easily in a host and typically infect the host through fecal-oral contamination, but can also be transmitted from host to host by blood. Think mosquitoes or other biting insects for transferring. Here's some common examples. Giardia, so beaver fever, most often due to contaminated water from fecal matter. I had a dog that got that, Stephanie.
Oh, gosh.
And they thought it was parvo at first because symptoms are very similar. Was not parvo, was Giardia. I just can't believe I had a dog that got Giardia because every dog I know drinks out of a puddle.
Right.
But that one got beaver fever.
That one.
Coccidiosis. I've had this happen in chickens and pigs. My very first pigs got this.
I had it happen in a dog.
Really?
Yeah.
So that's one that infects species specific. Mm-hmm. So you can't get it from chickens, that kind of thing. And entamoeba, so dysentery. There are lots of versions of this. This is the second time the Oregon Trail has come up. You have died of dysentery.
Dysentery.
Not good.
No, it's really not great.
No, don't do that. Don't do it. And then helminths, I think that's how you say it. I'm not going to look that one up. Helminths. This is what most think of when you're thinking of parasites. So they look like worms. These are multicellular organisms that are typically visible when in their adult form. So their full form, you're going to notice them in large quantities usually. And depending on what type they are and what stage they are in, they can live in various areas of the body. A common misconception is that they can only live in the gastrointestinal tract, and this is simply not the case. So common examples are flatworms, roundworms, and whipworms. Whipworms like gross me out more than roundworms, but
worms, I don't know in general.
Why. Yeah.
Worms in general are pretty disgusting. Yeah.
And ectoparasites, so these poor things are often forgot about as a parasite until you're dealing with them. This classification can get pretty broad, but for now, think of parasites that can reside and thrive externally, like lice, ticks, fleas, and mites. The term mange is actually just very small mites, and therefore ectoparasites. I know for a fact when you see giant lice on your pig, you can absolutely lose your mind trying to like itch and check yourself for those nasty huge things. Like you'll lay awake at night thinking that you have pig lice on you, and they're huge. Like when you see them, they're shockingly huge.
Pig lices?
Yes, but you can't get them. Fun fact.
Right.
And you have to understand that not all parasites can attack different kinds of hosts. So zoonotic parasites are the type that can transfer from animal to people. It doesn't have to necessarily be, say, pig to person or chicken to person. It could be chicken to pig or crossover like that. So that's what zoonotic means, is that it can jump from one host to another type of host. There are zoonotic viruses as well, but the term zoonotic just means that a disease or parasite is able to spread from animals to humans, or it can spread from one species of animal to a completely different species. And here are just a few examples of zoonotic parasites. So toxoplasmosis, I just could only think of you, Stephanie, when I read this because you were so terrified of it.
Well, yeah, go ahead. There's not the time and place for a soapbox rant. My tongue is bleeding.
I know. She's really trying hard not to voice her opinion, but this is one of the most common zoonotic parasites that affects cat owners in particular, or if you have a cat that's coming to your garden and pooping in your garden and you're digging in the spring and uncover their nastiness, you're at risk for this. And it's a parasite that lives in the intestines of cats who get it from mice. And when they poop, they shed some in their poop. And when the human pets them and, say, for example, eats a sandwich, it passes into your intestines and grows. Or if you are changing a litter box, you can breathe them in and become a host yourself. This isn't necessarily harmful to a regular human, but it can cause major problems if you are pregnant. And that is why pregnant humans should never change litter boxes.
Yeah, like abortion, major problems.
Yeah, absolutely. So never, ever change a litter box. Or if you know that a cat's been pooping in your flower box, don't be messing with that. Yes. So, and then the next one that everyone really thinks of is trichinosis. This one I'm absolutely terrified of to an unreasonable degree. I don't know why.
Bears.
Remember? Bears. See, and I'm fine with alive bears, but if
they're
I have to skin out a bear, I'm absolutely not doing it. I refuse.
Which is hysterical because I've skinned my fair share of bear. Not real bear. I've fleshed bear hides many a time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not into it. No, thank you. So this used to be really common in domestic pigs, but now it's very rare in pigs. Not to say that it's unheard of. It's just with domestication, we had a large amount of it, and now it's less so because we kind of tend to cull all the ones that had it. Anyway, it's a helminth that can cross over from mostly bears into humans, and it can live in undercooked meat. So if you're going to consume bear, just be very careful. Like, measure the temperature of your meat. It can be very serious.
Species-specific parasites are the typical parasite a small farmer or homesteader is going to deal with. And these do include lice. So lice is species-specific, meaning they can't transfer from a pig to you, and you can't pass lice onto your pigs, which is a huge relief, because after you deal with an animal with lice, you're going to scratch. Actually, Chicken, our Hereford, had lice when we first got her. And lice isn't something you always have to treat either. In Colorado, cows named Chicken, cows get lice sometimes in the winter. And then as soon as things warm up and the sun's out, the lice just die. So yeah, anyways, but
that's pretty common.
Yeah, Chicken was my first real cow experience. And she had lice and I was like panicked about it.
You're like, can I get this?
Yeah, you cannot talk about lice and not get itchy. It's just one of those things.
Yeah.
So life cycle of parasites. So, and this is like perhaps the biggest takeaway and something that you wouldn't think you need to understand, but you do. So we all know that chicken eggs take 21 days to hatch. Turkey eggs take 28 days to hatch. And geese eggs can take up to 35 days to hatch. The same is true for parasite eggs. I like how you wrote that. Like, we all know this.
Well, don't we?
With that being said, the treatment that you're going to do is going to be different for each type of parasite. And this is why it's important to identify what you're dealing with prior to the treatment. So we're going to go with the easiest example of an internal parasite in pigs, just because it's the most typical parasite that is discussed. But know that all living creatures can be affected by parasites, and pigs are not really disgusting. People like to make them out to be filthy animals. They're just not. And the truth is, we're all kind of filthy animals. So
it's true.
Right. Pigs are like, actually, after you've been around pigs, they're pretty clean.
Well, that's the thing that drove me crazy. So I had pigs first. Uh-huh. They will not poop in their house. If their house is the right size, they will always go outside and make sure that their poop is far away from where they eat or they're sleeping. And cows just could not care less.
No, most cows. Yeah, it's kind of rare to have one. Some of them do, but not very many of them.
No, they're just delightful to poop in the fresh straw that you provided.
Yeah. And if they're a dairy cow, they will only poop.
Oh,
and then lay directly to where it's only the udder that completely goes into the poop, right?
Yes.
Anyhow, so the parasite eggs enter the host. In this case, we're talking about roundworms. And this can be from infected food or infected grounds or another animal even. Next, the larvae hatch and travel through the lungs and the liver, which can cause the pig to cough because the larva is actually burrowing out, which is so disgusting.
It's so gross.
The pigs cough them up and swallow them. So the larvae go then into the stomach, and the larva will start to develop and mature in the intestine. And then once they're in the intestine, they'll begin to lay eggs. And keep in mind that one female can lay up to 200,000 eggs a day. And the eggs are now free balling on the soil and then eaten by another pig. And then the cycle repeats.
Right.
So what is interesting here is that the eggs can lay dormant in the soil under harsh conditions for years. So don't think that you'll never have an issue with them, because if your animal's touching the ground, there's a chance.
Right.
And then just because you can't see parasites doesn't mean that they're not there. And I would say that's most common the case, is that you won't be able to see the worms that you're dealing with or the parasites that you're dealing with.
Once you do see them, you know that it's been a full-fledged issue for longer than just that day.
Yeah. Yes. Typically, you'll start to see roundworms when they're being shed through the poop. And this means the adults aren't your biggest issue here. It really is the eggs and the females that have already laid and are shedding. So if you see one animal pooping spaghetti, assume that all animals are infested and are now hosts. So you don't just want to kill the adult worms, but you need to stop those eggs from becoming adults, who then go on to lay more eggs. So this is why choosing the right dewormer and the right increments is so important. So both are contributing factors, but I feel like people know already to choose the right dewormer. People don't know about the increment in the redosing. And that's why it's important to know the life cycle.
Yeah, and what you're fighting off here.
Yes, because you're going to, in theory, like, kill all of the adults, and you need to hit them again before they get to being adults again, right?
So yeah.
When you know that, then you have a chance. If you don't know that, you don't have a chance.
Because here's the deal. Ivermectin will not kill those eggs. It won't touch them.
Right.
It will kill the adult worms, but again, that's not your biggest issue.
Right.
Whereas fenbendazole will, I'm sure I messed that up, but it will kill the eggs and the adult worms, but you have to do it for what is the recommended dosage and how long, because there's different ways to treat. So that's why reading the packaging is important.
Right. And a quick interjection here with our standard disclaimer that we are not your veterinarians.
Right.
Nor are we anybody's veterinarians. And we're not giving you veterinary advice. This information is to be used for entertainment only. Please call your vet if you are experiencing any of these symptoms.
This has been a Milkmaid's PSA.
We have to do it.
Yeah.
So, fenbendazole is a medicated feed. It doesn't have to be a medicated feed, though.
It can be a paste.
It can be a liquid. It almost can be all always sorts of things.
Orally given. Mm-hmm. Whereas ivermectin is almost always, it's a paste too, but like, who knows how good that is. Though ivermectin is usually intramuscular treatment.
Yeah.
Or a poron. It's just depending on what animal you're treating too, because poron is not for pigs. It's only for cattle.
Yeah, ivermectin comes in about every form you could think of.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's pretend we're treating a hypothetical pig. So we're going to pick up Safeguard. Safeguard is a brand name for fenbendazole.
Yeah.
Right? And in this example, we're going to use medicated feed. So always read the directions on the back prior to treating the pig. Side note, we know people like to use ivermectin on pigs at the site of worms, and we used to do that too. However, the Montana state vet told Tara that ivermectin only kills the adults. And we want all the creepy crawlies dead, right? Because if you only kill the adults, eggs are going to hatch and create more adults. And if you don't nail that timing absolutely perfectly, you're just going to keep chasing your tail.
Yeah.
So to nail it perfectly, you'd want to do multiple rounds 10 days apart. But we feel like the absolute best practice is to go ahead and use fenbendazole, because not only does it kill the adult parasites, but it gets the eggs too. However, it's only good for internal parasites. So external parasites require ivermectin. More on that later. And the best practice for medicated feed is to feed it as a complete feed for 3 to 12 days at a low dose noted on the bag. And it goes off weight of your pig. So that's what we do.
And it says that on most bags too, separate out the smaller ones if you're having a crowding issue. That's not a bad place, but you can also make sure that you have several different places for them to eat. There's several ways to do it. And again, just watching your pigs or whatever animal you're treating is good, so you know that they're all getting it.
Right. So parasites in all animal herds are very common, and it's just important practice to use good stocking rules, monitor the health, and establish a baseline for your herd. And you can do this on your own, or you can take a sample to your vet. Good deworming practice is best. And for us, that means deworming in the spring and the fall. We also deworm all of our piglets at weaning, and then again, a month and a half or so prior to butcher. And Tara and I went on
back
this
and forth.
Back and forth, because here we'll get more into this in a minute, and maybe I just leave it, but what is considered best practice as far as deworming has changed wildly over the years. It was only just use this one type of dewormer, it works perfect
for the rest of their lives,
right? And then that stopped working, so then it changed to deworming monthly, and then that stopped working, and then it changed to deworming with two different kinds, spring and fall.
Yeah.
And then now it's changed to testing first and then deworming. And we'll kind of get into the reason more as to why that is the case. But the deworming battle is ever changing. So.
And I forgot this, Stephanie. So with my cattle, I don't really, it's not a huge concern as it is with pigs. If you've ever watched little pigs, they'll just chew on anything because that's how they're learning to root, right? Because so much of their sustenance comes from rooting in nature. So they're just built to root.
Right.
With pigs, they almost always do get roundworms as babies.
Yeah.
So that is why we chose to deworm, because we know that it's probably going to be an issue if we didn't.
Right. And just as a, in general, young animals and old animals and immunocompromised animals are the ones that are going to have the worms.
Right.
Or just parasites in general, not necessarily only worms, but.
So if you're not sure, what I did have a worm problem on pigs that I bought from somebody that never dewormed before. Obviously, like there's always going to be issues, right? And I was like, I'll play it and see if they do have worms. Turned out they did. So I dewormed, knowing what I was dealing with by just visibly seeing. And then I dewormed, and then I took a sample a few weeks later to the vet to confirm that there wasn't anything bad happening. And it was confirmed there was nothing showing there. Totally normal numbers. So that's a way to do it too, if you're unsure.
A note on testing. It is normal for an animal to have a parasite load.
Yes.
For the record.
That's what establishing a baseline for your herd is.
Yeah.
Is this, you literally take poop and look at it under a microscope and count.
Right. And there's like a set. Well, maybe we'll talk about test results, because we're planning on doing a episode on fecal testing as well. Maybe we'll just save what's normal on numbers there until then. How about that?
That's good, because we didn't write anything down.
Perfect. You want to treat all of your same species for parasites on the same day, and that just gets into the life cycle thing. So this is because you don't want the life cycle of the parasite to continue and thrive for a few days in one host and reinfect the ones you've already treated. So assume they're just all infected and treat them all if you have a problem with any of your animals. So if you have a seller that insists that they never deworm with meds and haven't had any issues, they're lying. So a lot of people are on this natural thing. So we'll get into that more at the end. But you'll run into people who are more and more saying that these animals have never been dewormed. So countless times, like Tara was just saying, she's purchased pigs that weren't dewormed, and then all of them were incredibly wormy. So a good protocol for bringing any new animal onto your farm is to isolate for 30 days, deworm, and provide the necessary vaccines if applicable, and watch and inspect that animal closely for 30 days. So don't touch them and then go touch the rest of your herd. It should get biohazard skills. And that's not just with deworming. Like the advice is the same, but that goes for any disease or condition, period.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And not only touching your boots, like in a perfect world, you would have different boots for the animal came in. So the absolute worst feeling is introducing an animal that has mange that you didn't catch into your clean herd and having to treat your entire herd due to your unwillingness to isolate the new animal. Ask us how we know.
Yeah.
You dealt with mange, and I had a very close call with CAE and goats.
Yeah.
So it can happen. It's a pain in the neck to isolate animals, and also the animals hate it. It's not what you want to be doing.
No one is happy.
Right. Right. But it is what it is, and you got to in order to keep your animals safe.
Exactly. So type of dewormers by species. The beef cattle one is a little bit more advanced because it will apply to all of them, just broken down by what they are.
And also there's a lot of money in beef cattle, so there's a lot of things labeled exactly. for beef cows.
The studies done on beef cattle are so far advanced compared to pigs, goats, dairy cattle even. It's just...
No one even knows what goats are.
Mind-blowing, right.
Science goats don't exist. Doesn't know goats exist.
No,
right.
There's no money to be made in goats, really. No, so
there's really
like,
not.
No. So let's talk about macrocyclic lactones, also known as endecticides. They come in pour-on or injectable formulas, and it's important to follow directions on the packaging for literally every dewormer that you're going to use. These do kill internal and external parasites via nerve paralysis. And here are just the most common types. Ivermectin, eprenomectin, doramectin, and moxidectin. The pros to these are that they last longer, and you need to see the packaging for exact control times. They are very convenient, and they cover internal and external parasites. So when you're running these animals through the chute twice a year, you can just go ahead and give this, typically once. So benzimidazoles or white dewormers work differently because they are only administered orally and work by interfering with the microtubules of the parasites, which cause the parasites to lose their energy supply and perish. These are short-lived compared to endecticides, however. Here are some common types. Expendazole, fenbendazole, and albendazole. The pros to these are that it is oral and the effects are rapid, good at controlling internal parasites, but again, only internal. And the cons, though, is that it's really only good for 2 days. And with cattle, that can be a giant pain in the ass to get 100 head to take doses over a 3-day period. Like, you can do better with swine because they'll just eat it.
Right.
So with dairy cattle, this is where you need to be extra careful to consult a vet and triple check the packaging information and do a lot of your own research. Keep in mind, you need to specify to your vet that your cow is a milk cow or is intended to be a milk cow so that they can help you find the correct dewormer. Because you just say a cow and they assume beef cattle in this country anyway.
Yeah, and goats too. It's the same way that people, any milking animal needs this exact same caution.
Yeah, it's very serious because no withdrawal times have been established from some of these dewormers. So we don't know what is shedding into the milk. That's not good. That includes ivermectin. So ivermectin doesn't have an established withdrawal time for milk. So if you give it to a cow, you have no idea how long to withdraw that milk, which means throwing it away. And then cydectin is one of the most popular for milking animals, and it's an endecticide too. And this can be used on beef cattle as well and is utilized as a pour-on. And the benefit here is that there's no withdrawal time needed for milk or for butchering. Aprinex is another common brand, and it's also a pour-on dewormer. And this dewormer covers a broad spectrum of parasites and is another good option. And again, no withdrawal time is needed for slaughter or milk. And there are multiple other ones, but this hopefully will get you started. But with goats, like Stephanie was saying, unfortunately, almost nothing is labeled for them. But popular chemical products include albendazole, fenbendazole, ivermectin, levamisole, and moxidectin. One note on goats in particular is that goats like to graze on taller forages. And this is important because larvae transfer from the environment to the animal, and it occurs most in the first 4 inches of the grass or forage. And that is to say that if you can keep your goats moving and only eating tall forages, you will be significantly ahead of the battle.
Yeah, goats are like the only thing that you can truly, I mean, rotating pastures is always a good idea and it does help cut things down. But goats, you can have a good, really good success rate with just keeping up on the forages just based on the way that they eat.
Yeah. And then sheep, tramadol, levamisole, and ivermectin are among the more popular chemicals products for sheep. And again, like we were saying with a dairy cattle, if you have a dairy goat and a dairy sheep, those will be different. You can't just use a broad spectrum like ivermectin, and you just don't know the withdrawal time for milk. So be cognizant of that. And then swine, the most common two are ivermectin and fenbendazole. They do make another product called Wyzine too, and you put it in water, but it's practically useless. So don't do that.
Right.
And lastly, poultry. Fenbendazole is the only one labeled for chickens and turkeys.
Yeah, there's, if you Google chicken dewormers, you're going to find lists of them. It's going to look like there's a gazillion options.
Yeah.
All of those products that is not fenbendazole are all natural ones.
Yeah.
Yeah, because even in researching this, I was like, oh, wow, look, there's a lot. Oh, wait, that's garlic or whatever. It's kind of, you know, concerning. What I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, because people are just trying to make money off of backyard chicken keepers, basically.
Right, exactly. Yeah, we'll get into the garlic in a minute.
So, we will. We certainly will.
Right. I'm just going to put my feet up and let you take that whole section.
You know that I get passionate about parasites. Side note, I have friends that host another podcast called the Rants and Raves podcast. Uh-huh. And they did this story on fish, which you know for a fact that fish are just incredibly wormy naturally, right?
Right.
They're just disgusting. Like, I won't eat fish because of that. It just grosses me out. I'm very weird about these things. Anyway, this
we think you're bizarre.
Yes.
Did you hear that?
He agrees. This family bought frozen fish at Costco and then took it home that day and cooked it. And then they ate a little bit of it and then they saw moving parasites in it.
Ugh.
So they sued Costco. Like, they're actively suing Costco. But here's the deal. If you would read the packaging, you would see that it says to cook the meat for 100...
to a certain temperature.
To 145 degrees Fahrenheit and hold it there for 15 seconds to kill all the parasites.
Right.
Clearly, if you see wiggling worms, you didn't cook your fish properly. That's a handling issue. That's not a Costco issue.
Right.
I'm so mad about it. Like, cook your fish, people.
Yeah, that's just good for meat in general. Parasite resistance is a whole situation. So I'm going to try and keep, again, off the soapbox on this one. But for decades, the advice of veterinarians has been to deworm on a schedule, right? Like I was saying, at first it was only one dewormer. This works, use this. Then it went to every month. Then it went to spring and fall and to rotate. Now the gold standard is to test and to treat species specific for what you have. The way that parasites work is similar to the way that bacteria work. So the only reason I phrase it like that is that most people are familiar with how resistance works in terms of antibiotics. And this is the same. So giving dewormer after dewormer limits the competition and lets parasites who are mutated and resistant to the dewormer multiply and now become the dominant variety, leading to a parasite that is wholly unaffected by dewormers, right? Which makes our dewormers less and less effective. So the perfect or worst, rather, case study for this parasite resistance is seen in barber pole worms, and it's really quite awful. So this parasite affects mostly sheep and goats, and barber pole worm is a blood sucker, and it gives the animal severe anemia. And in acute cases of this, you'll just go out and find your animals deceased, like seemingly without explanation, until you do more research.
Super or more scary.
Investigating, rather. So the problem with, I mean, there's a gazillion, but there's the main problem with the barber pole worm is that they're mostly resistant to everything. So if you have a barber pole worm problem, you're kind of on your own. It's like, good luck.
Shoot.
Right? Yeah. Your only hope there is to work closely with a veterinarian. Be prepared for intensive testing to see what it is and why it isn't working, or what is and isn't working on your particular herd. And if you don't have a veterinarian, this is where I would get aggressive. Contact your extension office, contact the state ag college, a local teaching hospital, like any veterinary school is a good place to start too.
Yeah, state vets.
They can be wildly helpful. Yeah, and state vets. Just like, here's the thing. You can feel like you're being obnoxious or nosy or whatever, right? But we kind of need to get loud on these sorts of things, because if it's not perceived to be a problem, science will not donate the money to fix it.
No.
Right. So we need to be reporting all of the barber pole infestations and just try and put enough pressure on scientists to get funding to do studies. It's not that scientists don't care, but there's got to be funding there.
Right.
So unless you're a deworming scientist, it is very easy to feel helpless in the fight against parasites. One thing that we can do is manage our herds and select only for animals who are either resistant or more likely resilient to parasite loads. And it is considered normal to have a small load of parasites. All animals do. But there are certain animals that don't seem to show the effects from parasites. Their bodies and immune systems are really good at keeping the parasites at bay and also not suffering from any of the side effects of a parasite load. So these are the animals that we need to find and continue to breed.
Just like selective breeding.
Yeah. And just like the parasites breeding to become more resistant to dewormers, we can breed our herds to become more resistant to the parasites.
Yeah.
So that's like the only true thing that you have control of, because we can't guarantee that another dewormer is going to come along that's going to fix any of this.
Right.
Hopefully it does.
But ultimately,
and it's really no different than like what you were just saying with your pig, is selecting for the ones that can handle it.
Yeah.
If you had a cow that got milk fever and almost dies every single calving, you're not going to keep that cow around.
Calling me out.
No, you've had that happen once and it was mild. It's happened once and it was mild.
Yeah.
If you have a cow that gets mastitis every time she comes off of antibiotics, you're not going to keep it around. It's the same thing. And we need to treat parasite resilience as a very good quality. It would be nice if that was advertised, right?
Right.
This cow gives 5 gallons a day and is parasite resilient, you know?
Yeah.
Let's normalize that.
That's a good way of looking at it. So natural dewormers, we're just going to debunk some of these because there are scientific papers and studies done on these to
or
debunk
lack thereof
them.
Too.
Yeah, right. There's nothing proving it. Like,
right.
If you just Google, say for example, number one, listen to this, pumpkin seeds, dewormer. You're only going to find things that meet your bias. So if you believe that they work, you're only going to see things that say this works. But there's no scientific proof, right?
Ran into that when I Googled diatomaceous earth. It was like homestead blog after homestead blog after
or
homestead
YouTube
blog.
Or YouTube after YouTube after YouTube.
Like, okay, this is not science.
No, it's not. And the really cool thing is that almost all of these do have science backing them as to why they don't work and why you should avoid them. So let's get into that. There are a lot of dewormers that are being sold as, I wouldn't call them dewormers, fake dewormers that are natural, holistic, or whatever marketing term you'd like to throw in there. Marketing something as natural, there's absolutely no control over people saying something's natural. So you could sell a piece of plastic and call it natural.
Yeah.
When clearly it's not. There's no control over it. Like the FDA isn't saying you can only label this, this, or this natural. The term is so broad that labeling anything natural is fine. Like nobody cares, right? And I get asked that a lot about soap, and I say, they're like, well, is it all natural? And it's not a term that I like to use because it is such a broad term. It absolutely means nothing.
Right.
And we believe that this is all nonsense and on a systemic level. Most of these people who tote these do not have before and after tests confirming that the natural dewormers are working. And every time they have been testing in an environment that allows for control, they have been proven to be ineffective.
I have a natural goat book actually
by
Gina Nicholas Caldwell as well. But she said in there, she's like, I used to support like natural dewormers and I use them every time and I never had a problem. And I told everybody I know, I use them every time and I never have a problem. But she's like, and then one day I stopped and guess what? I still didn't have a problem.
So it's like
a lot of people just use them and are like, I don't have any problems. Well, did you have one before and did it work?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good way of looking at it. Just because it doesn't happen doesn't mean that it's working.
Right.
So we understand why people think these work. And let's just talk about our favorite, diatomaceous earth, or like the worst.
Right.
Diatomaceous earth is ground up diatoms, which are just little tiny creatures from the sea. And it is used as 100 different things from dynamite suppressant?
Uh-huh. That was the first thing it came up as.
Dynamite suppressant to filtration to the abrasive component in metal polishes.
Let's feed it to our animals.
Yeah. Let's put it in our milkshakes and our morning coffee.
Right.
Where it applies to our conversation today is that it also acts as quote unquote an insecticide.
Well, it does work as an insecticide for sure.
For certain things. The fine powder is said to absorb lipids from the waxy outer layer of the exoskeletons of many species of insects, but not all, And this layer acts as a barrier that resists the loss of water vapor from the insect's body. Damaging the layer increases the evaporation of water from their bodies so that they can dehydrate, and often fatally. And do you know what it's worse for? Like, the worst bug that is affected by this? Bees, honeybees, because of all of their fuzziness on their bodies. It sticks to their fuzzies, and then they bring it back to the hive, and then everyone gets cut up from it.
Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm. So if we emphasize how this stuff works, the powder absorbs lipids from the bugs, which leads to death. It only works as a powder absorbing stuff. So what happens when an animal puts the powder in its mouth? The powder absorbs saliva and it's done. So unless the animal has mouth parasites at that exact moment of consumption, the DE will all be used up long before it ever gets to the intestines. To further this, read the packaging. Most say not effective as an insecticide when wet. What is it doing in the stomach? Being dry? Is it dry in the stomach?
Right.
And this stuff is sold as food grade because it is intended to be used as an anti-caking agent. And most packaging even specifies exactly how to do that. So lastly, if you do decide to use it regardless, please use caution as the silica in it is a lung irritant. So don't breathe it in at all. And studies in labs have shown that DE causes lung cancer in mice, and we do not know the effects it can cause on your animals breathing it in, let alone you or your children. And we have seen people free feed it, and to be honest, it really has no place as a dewormer or a mineral on the farm. So garlic has been shown to work, but not as a dewormer. The thought is that the garlic is helping the immune system, which in turn is taking care of the parasites. But we would argue that you should save yourself the insane amount of money on a lifelong supply of garlic and just get genetics that do the same thing. So it's not necessarily the garlic, it's the good immune system that is helping fight off the parasites. Another fan favorite, pumpkin seed. With my research, I found that there is a compound on the seeds that would act as a dewormer, but the problem is no animal on the planet Earth is able to eat that amount of pumpkin seeds necessary in one sitting for it to work. So throwing in several pumpkins and calling it good simply isn't the answer, as it wouldn't be enough to affect the parasites. But there are promising studies showing that pumpkin seed tinctures do help, which may be a good answer to the dewormer resistance we are now seeing, but as of now, no natural deworming method has been proven to be effective.
Yeah, and like, it's one of those things. We obviously, there's a problem with chemical dewormers in the resistance situation, right? Yeah. And to date, there has been zero natural methods that are effective. Some people look at the future and say that, you know, between genetics and exploring different natural methods, maybe we'll be able to get ahead of that way. And maybe we will, right? Maybe natural will come through. If you think we're ridiculous, just do tests. Do the natural stuff. Get a test result before, get a test result after. And if you want to do it right, you're going to lock up your animal on a 100% concrete slab using filtered water that's covered and enclosed so birds and other parasites can't come into your controlled system.
Yeah.
And then run some tests.
Right.
If you're so inclined, I think that would honestly be great. I'm using it in a little condescending because people tend to quote unquote run tests without considering any of the other controls. Testing is the ultimate if you're going to experiment with dewormers.
Yeah.
Is really the end all be all. And we will be doing, I don't know exactly when, maybe next, maybe in a time down the road, we will be doing an episode on doing fecal testing so that you could get set up to do it at your own house too.
Yeah. So thanks for coming to our talk about parasites. I know it was enthralling.
Thank you for coming to my TED Talk.
My TED Talk on parasites. All right. Well, thanks, Steph.
Yeah, we will talk. I got to go.
He wants to talk too.
Seriously.
Happy milking.
Happy milking.
Bye.